Hello everybody, and welcome to Linux Voice, Series 5, Episode 14. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Efrad.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
And unfortunately, the fourth man, Mike Saunders, has fallen victim to the just legendarily poor German public transport system. Yeah, we always knew that it was a liability having a team member over there, which is it's basically a shantytown, Munich. But he's struggled on until now. But now it's got the better of him. He's going to hitchhike on a donkey or some whatever it is that they do in Germany. So we'll struggle on. We'll bring you in stoic, stiff upper lip fashion some news, some discoveries. There will be a dramatically inefficient vocalise your neurons because Mike isn't here to vocalise them. But we're going to come back with a red, white and blue voice of the masses.
Yes, we will save Europe again. I knew that's where you were going.
Oh, I'm so predictable. I just need to get some new ideas. It's been a decade now. I've just been chuntering in the corner about the same old stuff. If you like the sound of this, but
by the Daily Mail.
Let's be honest. If you like the sound of this, you can buy the Daily Mail, or you can subscribe to Linux Magazine, which is linux-magazine.com, and our words, many of our words are in there. Also, if you buy a subscription, you get access to the complete back catalogue, which includes the back catalogue of Linux Voice. So, it's money well spent. We've not said this much, to be honest enough, but the company behind Linux Magazine gets free software. We should really acknowledge that because there were other people interested in Linux Voice and they didn't really get free software. So, without further ado, let's have some free software news.
Some free software news. Right. Let's start with some good news this fortnight. In the last podcast, we talked about Critter and they got into a bit of a knot with their tax and financial situation and things were looking a bit bad. So they started up their fundraising and it's had a fantastic response. They're just swimming in money now. So they can pay their developers. That's a technical term. It's an accountancy phrase.
And, don't tell the tax man.
Yeah. We assume it's being reported correctly to the tax man. It's hard to know. They sorted out their tax situation. They're paying their developers again, and it's all looking good for them. So, big shout out to everyone who supported Critter.
Do you know how much they got?
I did look it up. So here we go. I've got the page open. So the first thing is they got $20,000 from private internet access.
Oh, yes.
And they've raised another 37,000 euros at the time we're recording this.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So it's been like hugely successful. These things sort of come up every once in a while when a free software project gets into trouble as a fundraiser. And it's always a little bit, it's both heartening and sad to see how effective it is, because on the one hand, it's really good to see everyone rallying around it. But at the same time, we shouldn't need these things to kick us into action to supporting the projects that we use all the time.
We don't have a better... Well, sorry, Andrew.
No, I'm just about to say that in a recent issue of Linux Magazine, you may have seen my column on a related topic, which is that we live in a capitalist society. It is assumed that your motives for performing a good or service are that you want to make money, but if you strip money out, as we have in altruism or in free software, that the whole system just breaks down because people just don't get it. So the tax man will have naturally assumed that Critter are rolling in cash and so therefore need to be taxed, but actually it's just not the case at all. And it is heartening that people can put their hand in their pockets to support worthwhile causes, but it totally shouldn't be this way.
No.
But the Heartbleed thing was my example with was it OpenSSL? It's just that software, that technology is worth billions and trillions, and yet it's worth nothing at the same time. Whereas, it's just a bizarre market breakdown.
While at the same time, Amazon halves its UK tax bill.
So now it's only paying 50p.
I think it's paying. It's paying 7 million.
7 million pounds.
Yeah.
Off of, is it 7 billion of UK turnover? Good work. Well played, Amazon. But those nurses don't.
That's profit. You see,
they'll work for money.
They only get taxed on the profit. That's what they say, you know. And who is it who owns Amazon? He hasn't got a penny, has he?
Is it Desmond Tutu? Does he run it as a charitable foundation?
Oh, we're so predictable. This is the angry free software class.
We've all been... Ben, you need to move on to a heartwarming bit of news next.
That was the heartwarming bit of news. It's all downhill from here.
Well, oh, no. We still need a good mechanism. I don't know what it is that... some easy micropayment system would help. I don't know. There's something hasn't happened that would help us, let us... I don't know, because I'm terrible. It's important to like support journalism, and I'm terrible at doing that personally as well. I don't know what it takes.
It has to be easy. Yeah. It has to be quick and convenient.
It does, and I think free software suffers from the same thing, although, you know, people are willing to respond when they need to. I don't know.
Should we move on to some more depressing news?
Do we have to?
No, let's move on to another happy bit of news.
Hey!
Solus 3 has been released. Oh. So this is...
excellent.
Unsurprisingly, the third release from the desktop, sort of desktop orientated distro. But the big sort of news in this, and the reason I've included it, is because it's included snaps. So this is Ubuntu's sort of sandboxing technology. And it's the first non-Ubuntu distro to have full support for snaps, although you can put them in. It does work with other distros, but this supports them completely out the box.
Ah, that is interesting. I don't know the answer. Is it are snaps like a first class citizen in Solus? Are they like do they support the standard package manager, or are they going to become the default way of installing packages?
What's going to happen in the future, I don't know. At the moment, it is... it's not replacing the package manager. It's alongside it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, although it's complete support, you could argue whether or not that's true first-class support.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's really good. I think, snaps are an excellent way of installing software.
I mean, it's interesting to see how it goes at the moment, because there's a whole snaps and Flatpak thing going on. It's not the sort of worst clash of technologies, because you can install them side by side, although I don't think any distro supports it out of the box. I genuinely think they're quite good pieces of technology, and I don't understand the situation well enough to really know the benefits of one versus the other. But they do seem, in the times I've used them, they have just worked, and worked in ways that sort of traditional package managers fail. That is sort of installing unstable software to stick it on without having a page full of unstable dependencies and then just getting rid of it at the end, or installing more than one version, which is sometimes something you would do on writing about stuff.
Yeah.
It's worked fantastically. Both Flatpak and Snaps have, when I've used them.
Yeah. And I think it, maybe not necessarily for us, but they're the answer to the problem of how do I download Firefox from the internet, or when beginners start using Linux and they want to just download the equivalent of an exe file and run it, something like a snap that you can download and then just run, or at least enter in the command on whatever distro you happen to be running and install it and run it. That's good.
I remember when I first started using Linux years ago, and I was like trying to get software, and it'd be like, oh, here's the Linux version. You download this tar.gzip file, and you'd be like, what do I do with this? You open it, and you've just got a load of C files on your computer.
Yeah.
And it was years before, well, not years, it was a long time before I worked out how to actually install software in Linux.
Yeah.
Because back then, I didn't have a manual or.
And that's, it's still all weird. I don't want to say it's a mess because I kind of like the freedom of it, but even still, every week I will install something from source. I might install something from a snap. I might install a raw D package that I've done. I might download through writing FOSPix. And in terms of security and vulnerabilities on my system, I don't even like to think of what I'm doing or trying to update it. It literally is the case that you use a distribution for a couple of years if you're lucky, and then you have to just tear it all down and start again because of the way that, you know, at least with some kind of consistency through a distro's chosen package manager alongside something like Snap, then you know exactly where you stand. You can see all your snaps, you can update, they update automatically, I think. You know, at least you've got some kind of, you know where you stand.
Yeah, I mean, PPAs, the personal package archives that you can use in Ubuntu, are fantastically useful for getting obscure software, but at the same time, they just give you enough rope to hang yourself.
Yeah.
I think every Ubuntu system I've ever had is just ground to a halt in the end, because I've just had too many PPAs installed with weird stuff in them. Some of them have been updated, some of them haven't, and it's just a complete nightmare.
Or installing things as root with NPM. You know, and the kind of plethora of the other kind of web-based or Node or Electron kind of package managers. And it's like, oh, God, I have no idea. Hundreds of megabytes of, you know, duplicated libraries, essentially, and no isolation, which is obviously what we need from, you know, both Flatpak and Snap.
Yeah, definitely.
And delta updates, those things are really important and distro agnostic.
Yeah. Yeah, just it makes it so much easier just to be able to say, this is a Linux version, it's a snap.
Yeah.
Just go and install it.
Yeah.
Hey, we didn't manage to make that sound depressing.
Yeah, I should try Solus. I've not tried it yet. It's a KDE distro, isn't it? It's a KDE-based distro.
No, they do have a KDE version, but their sort of flagship thing is Budgie, which is their own desktop.
Oh, okay.
Which, it looks really good. I've never used it sort of for a long period of time, but I've played with it a bit, and it's always seemed nice.
Well, maybe we should, challenge ourselves to use Solus before the next podcast, like in the old days. I'll challenge myself and report back next time.
I like those things. I'm going to challenge myself to buy a Linux laptop.
Okay, let's move on to our next bit of news. And this is B3FS has been deprecated in Red Hat's Enterprise Linux. And by extension, I assume Oracle and CentOS as well. And this, it's not necessarily major news for many people, because I assume relatively few people who use Red Hat actually use B3, because it's a sort of weird mix of technologies, a sort of new and the old. But I find it quite interesting from a technology point of view, because B3FS has been sort of sung as the future of Linux file systems for quite a long time now. And now Red Hat are saying that they're not willing to support it.
Well, I think it doesn't surprise me. I know that I've heard lots of good things about B3FS or ButterFS, and I've used it myself on one of my installations, and I do hit problems with it. I do hit consistency and performance problems with it, and I've had trouble retrieving data, which is semi-ironic considering the versioning built into the file system. It seems like it's one of those projects that's been in kind of a beta state for like 5 years, since we first probably announced that it was going to be in Red Hat or Fedora, or it started becoming included in mainstream distros. And I guess, I don't know, from an outsider's perspective, it looks like the project lost momentum and hasn't really delivered on its initial promise.
Yeah, it does feel like it's taken a long time to get stable. I know file systems always take a long time to get stable, but this, and I don't know how long it's been around now, but it's a long time.
Well, we interviewed at the time Valerie Aurora was working. She was one of the main developers on it, and that must have been 7 years ago, 6 years ago. And that was just the time when it was becoming, you know, a significant player in, you know, in all these. I think also, I don't know, but like ZFS, ZFS, everybody knows it kind of does what ButterFS does better. And it's the licensing thing that's holding the things back.
Yeah, and Red Hat seemed quite focused on XFS.
Yes,
I've no idea how you're supposed to pronounce that.
Probably ZFS.
Zf. I'm going to go with it. Yeah, so Red Hat focused on Zf. And I know there's
how's EXT3 doing nowadays?
Well, the latest one's EXT4. Actually, that's been in the news a little bit recently because they tried to sneak some changes into the Linux kernel after the deadline, and Linus has been off on one of his rants against the maintainer of it.
Almost the carbon copy of one of Linus's rants.
and the
classic kind of reaction from people who never have any who never normally read the Linux kernel mailing list. This is dreadful.
I think this is one of his more rational rants. I mean, it was someone trying to sneak some stuff in that shouldn't have been snuck in at that point.
Yeah, Linus is pretty abusive in his language and tone. I mean, this is what always comes up, but I know got to have a thick skin, I guess.
Yeah, I've got to say, I've never got over that time that I went to Linus's house and he didn't even offer us a drink.
We did nearly kill his wife.
Well, it swings around about, you know.
Yeah, he was lovely though.
He was lovely. if he wrote an abusive rant aimed at me now, having met him, I'd probably just go, oh.
Yeah. We had quite a heated discussion about a few things. I remember when I first went in, he felt that Android wasn't held back by the fact that there wasn't a landscape mode or something like that, as I remember it. And I was like, oh, God, no, you've got to have landscape mode. He's, no, it's unnecessary. Maybe he's right. I hardly ever use landscape mode.
How are you supposed to take videos if your phone doesn't have a landscape mode?
Yeah, but this generation doesn't know what landscape mode is. They take all their videos in, you know, portrait mode. Just so annoying. That's why it's blame Linus for that. Oh.
an influential man.
Snapchat's Linus's fault.
Okay, should we move on to some more Linux news? And that is that GR Security. The GR Security is a set of patches that can be applied to the Linux kernel.
How do you pronounce that? It's like security.
Come back on International Pirate Day.
Yeah, that's the Bristol Security Company there. Grr, security have been patching.
Right, stop being silly, you two.
Sorry, this is actually quite a serious piece of news.
Sorry.
So, grr, security. GR Security. Produce a set of patches for the Linux kernel, are suing Bruce Perens, who claimed that their patch set violates the GPL. And the way the licensing on their patches works is they release under the GPL, they'll sell you a license to apply it. However, if you exercise your rights under the GPL to distribute those patches to other people, they will refuse to sell you any future patches. And it's an interesting question as to whether or not is a breach of the GPL. I mean, I'm not a lawyer and I don't want to be sued, so I couldn't possibly say.
What court of jurisdiction is this action taking place?
America.
Okay. We're probably all right then.
Because our libel laws are like really lax in comparison. Yeah, and it's...
That doesn't sound very good, and it doesn't sound very... I mean, Bruce Perens has done
constructive.
Amazing things for free software. Why?
No, I mean, it seems to me to be against the spirit of the GPL, if not explicitly the terms.
Yeah,
although
yes.
Possibly explicitly the terms, I don't know.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like they've violated the letter of the GPL, though.
Well, there's a clause in the GPL about adding additional terms that restrict your rights further, and it basically says don't do that. And the question is whether or not this restricts your right further, because technically it doesn't restrict your right to that code, no, but it does to future code.
You can choose to sell your product to whoever you want to sell your product to.
Yeah, but can you? Because you're not... there's several cases where you companies have been sued for refusing to do business with people under discrimination law.
Yeah, but that's because they've let it be known that that was the reason why they were refusing the business.
Oh, it's
said, oh, you're a Pisces, so we're not going to sell to you.
It says in the GR security contract that Bruce Perens has put on his website that they explicitly say if you redistribute it, we will not sell you more software.
Okay. That doesn't come under discrimination laws, though, does it?
Maybe not. I have no idea.
Probably. It's fascinating, though. It's they're wrong and right at the same time. I love it. I wish I was a lawyer at this point. Then I could just pick a side to argue for and charge £100 an hour.
Can we legally quote Linus on this? Because he says, don't bother with GR security. Their patches are pure garbage.
So I don't think they're very libelous.
Litigious,
that's the word I'm looking for.
As our legal editor, I'm pretty sure you're okay to say that.
Okay. And regardless of whether they're legally wrong or right, it doesn't seem to be within the spirit of the game at all to me.
No, absolutely not.
I'm sure our listeners can think of their own adjectives with which to describe them.
Yeah. And it just doesn't make any sense, you know, going after Bruce Perens and, you know, someone who's been so important to the whole... So, you know, the business behind GR security is based upon Linux and open source and GPL, things that, you know, people like Bruce Perens have been, you know, cornerstones in their success. And then it's like, I don't know, it's biting the dog biting the hand that feeds it, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure they think to themselves that they'd be dealing with the business people and that's who they're selling to, and therefore they're not going to take this sort of thing into account. But in effect, the decision of whether or not to use this is going to be made by engineers who are often quite supportive of free software, and this is hardly going to do them any favours commercially, I'm sure.
It's terrible PR as well. And there is also a special place in the court of public opinion for people who counter-sue when they're wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Taylor Swift thing just recently, like, dude, just let it go. Let it go and no one will know you're a wrong'un.
Yeah, I have to agree with you with that Taylor Swift case.
Just let it go. Just let it go. Walk away. No one will know your
shake
name.
Shake it off.
what a silly man.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde should just have let it go. But instead, he went back in a civil suit and lost. And ah, dear. Anyway, at least we have the importance of being in earnest. What a superb work. And the selfish giant.
Should we finish on some happy news?
Yes.
I lied. We do actually have some happy news at the end. And that's That's a gnome or gnome, if you prefer, has turned 20 today as we record this.
Hey!
Happy birthday, gnome. Well done.
It's one of those things that it's both good news and it makes me feel really old. So it's good news that makes me sad.
That's the best kind of good news, though, isn't it? That's the sort of like Keats news where you just realise that all beauty is fleeting and that you're going to die soon.
That's what I look for in my news.
So, I mean, who'd have thought? I mean, so, okay, I'm going to use my maths to work this out. So that was... So we're in 1997. Who'd have thought, like, barely 5 years after the end of the Amiga, really, where software projects lasted a couple of years, that software projects would be starting up, like the Linux kernel, like KDE and like GNOME, that would span, you know, generations effectively. You know, that's incredible. Especially ones that don't have any kind of real corporate funding, although there's been many sponsors behind the GNOME project.
Yeah. That is actually mega, mega good news. That's super double plus good news.
Yeah. I saw some of the pictures from the birthday party and people, you know, people, great people like Karen Sandler, you know, still involved right from the beginning. And, you know, it's great to see that the community has that kind of longevity to it. And it's been an important pressure point on the whole free software community and, you know, is still a massively popular desktop.
Gnome has absolutely shaped the look and feel of free software. Yeah. Like if it was left to KDE, no one would use free software because it would look terrible.
But the windows would wobble.
You guys can have it today. It's the birthday party. I'm not gonna rain on your parade.
Yeah. And when you switch between desktops and Gnome, it doesn't zoom out of a cube, spin round, and then zoom back in.
Have they put virtual desktops back in then?
Actually, I'm not sure.
I think the Gnome developers watched Minority Report and thought, oh, that was a decent film. And not wow, we must reinvent our workflows with a spinny cube. We can all pretend to be Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Yeah. You've all got your touch screen. You've all got your touch screens now, haven't you, with your little Gnome environments?
I actually have got a touchscreen on my computer at the moment. I keep poking it. It's quite good fun.
Does your finger line up with where the actual pointer is? Because the last time I tried something like that, it was always like the offset was wrong.
I must say that the first time I saw like a giant, it was like a 36 inch screen with it was SUSE with Fedora. SUSE with Fedora, that's making any sense, sorry. It was SUSE with Gnome 3, the touchscreen version, and it looks so cool. Probably not that useful for getting work done, but it just looks amazing.
Yeah.
I think that's all the news this fortnight.
Thanks, Ben.
So, before we move on, the cat's climbed into a really squeaky chair. I just want to evict him.
I can't hear anything.
Okay, that probably means it hasn't been too bad. Zappa, out.
I'm not going to cut this out.
Well, all right.
Sorry.
All right, P. Zappa.
He bites me if I try and pick him up when he's lying down.
I feel bad now. I feel like Zappa should have stayed.
No, he came in with some feathers stuck to him, so he's probably killed a bird today, if that makes you feel any better.
Well, that's what cats do, isn't it?
Well...
Okay, so...
It's a circle of life.
Before I start singing Circle of Life... Let's go on to finds of the fortnight. Let's ISC on Linux Voice, ISC on Freenode. There are a few. In fact, it's spontaneous. People started spontaneously sharing their finds yesterday, so I've got to try and go back through them. I really should get more organized on this. So Ian Gogo says freepats.zenvoid.org, an open MIDI sound font site that needs people to submit more voices to help it have an open general MIDI sound set. So that sounds cool. So general MIDI is like, is it worth explaining? General MIDI is a common set of instrument sounds that, so that if you choose an instrument such as number 67, I don't know what number 67 really is, but it's a trumpet, say, you get a trumpet sound. So maybe there is a lack of quality samples and audio samples for things like that. So it sounds like people are coming together to try and create their own open MIDI sound font that people can then use to play back MIDI files that will sound good. I'm guessing that's great, because it's always good to see creative stuff have an open source kind of Creative Commons license. I tried to save some from when it all came up yesterday. So let's see. Some Aishipi, here's a find. There's some fantastic HD Palm options that the man pages tell you, in no uncertain terms, not to use. They're really quite amusing. I remember looking through this yesterday, and I can't remember the really good examples, but it's really funny. If you do go and have a look at some of the HD Palm options, and some of the hints as to why you shouldn't be using them, that's a really good find.
Every once in a while, I think I should make sure my SSDs are properly configured and working efficiently. Then I look at HD Palm and think, actually, you know what? They're probably all right.
Yeah. There are a couple more, but I don't want to waste everyone's time. Tracy C. I know it's a bit until the next podcast recording, but I have a find for it. Keep Pass XC. It's a fork of Keep Pass X. It's written in C++ and offers a native client for Linux. That's a really good find. I think I mentioned it in Fospix last time. There are probably a few more finds in the IRC channel, but I'll make a traditional hash of it and move on to something else that's easier to talk about. Shall I do a find? I've got a find that was mentioned on IRC, which I also found for myself, and that is that Java has been ported to the Commodore 64.
What?
I know, Java actually barely runs on my 8-core Intel i7, so I have no idea how it runs. But this was on boingboing.net. Back to the Future Java is a Java virtual machine that now runs on 8-bit computers. It's based on the version of Java that was made for Mindstorm. And it lacks things like garbage collection, which I guess, you know, is necessary to get it to run. And it runs on the Sega Genesis and on the Apple II. So I suppose the Commodore 64 isn't so surprising. But
so is this a deliberately stripped down version of Java in that you have to write code and compile code specifically for it?
I don't know. I'm trying to read up about it now. It lets you develop using Java, fully featured, preemptive threads, multi-dimensional arrays, exceptions, no garbage collection, and no switch statement. Limited support for long, provided standard library does not cover the full JSC library. It sounds like, and it's interpreted. So there's a demo of it running. Maybe I'll give it a go. I haven't got a working Commodore. I have actually in the loft, but it hasn't got any sound chip on it. So maybe find a demo that doesn't use sound and I can give that a go.
There must be like a Commodore 64 emulator.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem right, does it? It's like,
no.
Seeing if Java will run while you're emulating a Commodore 64.
Hang on, how does this work? So you put one tape in with Java, and that loads up. You don't have to take that tape out and put a second tape in with your Java file.
Well, I guess so. Or you could print out the listings in Java and then type them in. Yeah. Or you can. There are disk drives. I mean, I had a 5 1/4 floppy drive for my Commodore 64. I still have somewhere.
Okay.
The 1541C, because I had a slightly newer version than the old beige 1541. I wasn't going to make this a find, but for the brief Amiga section of the podcast, the open source VA2000 graphics card that I talked about a few months ago is really progressing quite nicely. They've got the SD card reader working on the FPGA that acts as a graphics card driver, and soon we'll be able to boot SD card off. We'll be able to boot Amiga OS off an SD card plugged into a graphics card on the Amiga, which is really exciting, because I don't know if you can remember, I really hated trying to get IDE to work again on the Amiga. It's horrible and clunky. Even though my Amiga's got SCSI, I'm using Compact Flash Card on the IDE interface. So to be able to plug cheap storage into the SD card and use that will be brilliant. And something that I can unplug and plug in as well. I may as well finish off with my final find, which you've probably heard about, but I've really only discovered in the last month or so, and this is Termux on Android. Termux is like a terminal, a Linux terminal for Android. If you've not used it, it's an open source terminal for Android that basically, it comes with a package manager, PKG, and it's all hosted on GitHub, that lets you run, like, I don't know, hundreds of Linux commands and utilities, just like BusyBox would or something like that, on your non-rooted Android phone. That's important for most of us. And it's incredibly useful. You can use it to SSH, for example. So install Termux, package install SSH, and then you can run SSH on the command line in Termux from your Android phone or tablet, just as you would SSH on anything else. And for the first time on Android, I really feel like this is a great terminal. You can, you know, it's great when you connect to other servers and do all the normal stuff that you would do. You can install Tmux. You can install Vim. So I have installed Vim, and that sounds slightly crazy, but because it augments the standard Android keyboard with, like, tab and control, and also you can hold down the volume down buttons and use the Vim buttons for navigation around things, it's actually really intuitive and clever, and you can create shortcuts. You know, you create a small shortcuts folder in your new Chroot home folder, and you can press on one link and it'll open up an SSH connection if you import the SSH keys to your remote servers. And I'm finding it really, really useful. It is open source and it's on FDroid. But, I mean, it's really worth supporting the developer on this. And if you buy it through Google Play, they'll get a couple of pounds. The main application is free, but there's things like a widget that will hover over any other running application, so you can have a terminal open while you're reading through browser instructions on Firefox, for example, on Android. And it's, if you've not used it, and I think a lot of people listening will already have installed it, it's the single best Android application I've found in the last year, I'd say. It's really good.
The thing that I've always struggled with whenever I've tried a terminal emulator on Android is the keyboard.
Yeah.
And you're saying that works.
I agree.
Basically.
You used to have to install, like, the hacker's keyboard on Android to be able to get access to all the special keys.
But, and even without that, it's just the stuff's not where you want it, and you're always clicking through different things to get stuff.
Yeah, well, this the good thing about Termux is that it augments your whatever keyboard you've chosen on Android. You get to use your normal keyboard, so you don't have to swap it out for something else. And then above that keyboard, it adds, like, the essentials like cursor keys and tab and control. So you can do, like, 90% of what you would do there with the control key. And then you can actually use the physical buttons on the side of your device to, like, hold down control and then use that for kind of navigating. WASD, I think, for some reason, is up cursor keys. I may be wrong, but that seems to... Or you can use the Vim navigation key. So of all of the keyboard setups that I've used, and the worst thing was actually having to switch to, like, hacker keyboard when you move to a terminal on Android, because you just simply couldn't get tab, for example, which I think is essential when you're typing out paths. I really haven't had a problem, and especially with clever use of kind of scripts and SSH keys to connect to other servers, it's really good. you know, if you've got Powerline installed in a remote server, it looks exactly like kind of Bash running on your local terminal. It's colourful. You can choose any kind of theme you want. It hovers over instructions while you're typing them out. And I actually choose to edit files in Vim on it because you can easily press, you know, escape. The escape is one of the keys that are added to the keyboard.
Yeah.
Give it a go. It's brilliant.
Yeah, that sounds pretty awesome. So if you hear any squeaking, Zappa's managed to break back into the room and he's trying to get back on the chair.
I can't hear anything.
I'm glad Zappa's back. I felt a bit traumatised, a bit triggered that he got chucked out earlier.
There you go. There he is. Sulking in the corner.
Good lad.
Anyone else want to share a find?
I don't have many finds, to be honest.
That's fine.
Not at least in the real world. I've got offered a job today, so
That's good.
Not going to be unemployed, which is nice.
Episode 3 of Masterminds on Friday.
Am I on that?
I don't know.
Oh, I don't, should find out, really.
Yeah, I think I've it's not like I'm obsessing over your, you know, I'm not like a super fan. But I did have a look on iPlayer today to see whether George Orwell was mentioned. And you have to sign into iPlayer now, and I really don't feel inclined to make an account, so.
Nah, fair enough.
I wonder if that means Get iPlayer doesn't work anymore. I haven't tried it.
It's not really a find or a discovery, whichever one we're doing nowadays, but if anyone hasn't read 1984... they totally should, especially if you live in the UK or America or Australia or any one of those daft countries.
It can't be many people who haven't read 1984 and yet still. I mean, what isn't it better to just live in ignorance of what happens? Well, you know, like cows going to the slaughter.
I just found out yesterday that a former colleague of mine, a very, very, very intelligent man, very politically aware chap, a black man living in the United States, had not read 1984. And I envy him almost the next 80,000 words of discovery, because it's just so cool. It's so relevant even now, even after, 69 years. Oh, it's coming out of copyright soon. Brilliant.
Is it? Then haven't they extended that pretty much? Don't they extend it every time stuff's about to come out of copyright?
They do for Cliff Richard, because he's a special case.
Okay.
I don't know about George Orwell. I doubt they would.
Isn't it? Okay. Was it 1984 that Amazon removed off all those Kindles?
Yes, it is.
it's wonderful, isn't it? The irony of that book. How on earth? I mean, okay, I really don't know this because I don't know much about George Orwell. But what was it that gave George Orwell the idea of this? Was it the fascism in Europe? You know, as it had happened, what was it that kind of instigated these thoughts into George Orwell's psyche?
Well, I think it goes all the way back. If you look at his first novel, Burmese Days, there's a section in that where one of the sub-magistrates starts dictating an official memo, and his language changes completely to the sort of parroted, preformed version of English that is officialese. And that's, you know, he came from the sort of the British civil service in India, where hypocrisy was the only way that the world ran.
Yeah.
It's very, very consistent. I was delighted to find that even in the, you know, 20 years before 1984, he was still thinking and writing about the same theme. So I think it must have been a lifelong... lifelong passion, really, just to expose the ridiculous and, you know, expose the soft underbelly of political oppression to mockery.
Yeah. But then it's not quite mockery.
Go out of fashion. What's this sort of frightened mockery?
Yeah.
The book I haven't read that's often sort of compared or mentioned in the same breath is A Brave New World. I know it's not Orwell, but it's a similar sort of vintage.
It's 32, is it? Brave New World. Aldous Huxley, he taught Orwell at Eton.
Okay.
French, English, one of the languages. That is a brilliant book, a very, very good book. And if you're going to read that, read We by Yevgeny Zamyatin as well, because read them backwards in that order, so 1984 first, because that's just bonkers. It's not as great a story, but it's very, very closely influences, rather, Zamyatin very closely influences, what's his face, Huxley. And yeah. Of course, he was living in the actual Soviet Union at that time as well, so his insights were rather less sugar-coated. My second discovery is that Marcus Hutchins, the security chap who prevented the NHS from melting down in a big fiery fireball of doom and being thrown into Mount Doom to be melted down along with the One Ring of Power, has been arrested in the United States for allegedly writing some malware that will steal your banking details. It all seems extremely implausible to me. But the really fascinating thing is the way that the exact same story with the exact same paucity of facts has been reported in various news outlets. So he says, I'm going to plead not guilty to this. And then the prosecutors have said, oh, well, we expect to find him guilty of this, this, and this. And the way that the Daily Telegraph has said is, so-called brackets, hero brackets, to be convicted of this, that, the other. And then the Guardian has said, WannaCry, savior of the NHS, to plead not guilty to whatever. And everyone's scraping the bottom of a very, very shallow, very thin barrel, because it's all subject to an ongoing trial, and so there's very, very little data coming out. But there's the same, like, just really sad attempts to, you know, spin this bloke as a weird, twisted hacker wearing a black fedora in his parents' basement, you know, watching weird Japanese cartoons, or else he's an absolute white knight for saving the world. And it's just bizarre, and I just don't really get it. I don't understand what's happening in this world today. That's it. That's me. It's not a discovery, is it? Sorry, it's always been the case.
I've got a related find that, actually. I was wondering about whether or not to talk about this, but it follows on from that quite nicely, so I will. I've just started subscribing to a magazine called Delayed Gratification. And the whole principle behind this magazine is to get completely away from the sort of current news cycle of always trying to be the first to report it, break news, blah, blah, blah. And they do 4 issues a year, and each issue is 3 months' worth of news, and it's released 3 months after the last month. So the current issue is a January, February, March issue. So it's got all the news from January, February, and March. But because enough time has passed now, they've actually been able to report it correctly. So rather than sort of rushing to get stuff out and loads of stuff being wrong, because that's just inevitable when you try and report on stuff as it happens, they wait and they do a proper job of reporting on the actual facts.
That's quite a good idea for a new section. We should do a news from January.
We could just replay an old podcast. Yeah.
We could just do each episode 3 months late. I don't mind doing that.
Yeah. We just have 3 months off, and then we'd still have to do episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I've only had one issue so far, and I'm really quite enjoying it. although it's got absolutely nothing to do with Linux or computing in general. My second and probably more controversial find is that I've just got a new laptop and I've decided to use Windows on it. And this is the first time in... Sorry. It's the first time and I can't even remember how many years that I've actually sort of used Windows regularly. It's Windows 10. I used Windows 7 a little bit a while ago, but that was just for one piece of software. I'd turn on, use that bit of software, turn it off again. And it's been quite interesting. I've only had it for a few days, so it's still just getting to grips with it. And it all feels quite strange and alien at the moment. And there's some stuff that just feels poor. Like I got completely in a knot with file permissions when something had it open, so I couldn't do it with something else. And it was just it. In fact, I couldn't change the name of a folder and I had a file inside that folder open in another application. And it was like, that shouldn't be a hard thing to do. And installing software is just horrible in Windows.
Is this a personal machine or is this your new secret job?
It's my new secret jobs machine.
Your new secret job makes you use Windows 10?
No, they wouldn't have an issue if I installed whatever I wanted on it. I just need a laptop and it came with Windows 10. I will need to use some Windows software, but I will probably at some point install Linux alongside it. But it's almost an intellectual challenge at this point just a curiosity really, using it.
I found it absolutely hateful. I used it for 4.5 months from December till May this year, and it just gets in the way of my brain.
To be honest, the biggest issue I've got with it at the moment is web browsing, and that's that both Firefox and Chrome work, but the performance is just a little bit off. So I'm using Edge, and that really doesn't feel as good to me. It's just the stuff there that should be easy that isn't, and so far I'm just going to give it a go and see what it's like, because I spent quite a long time talking about desktops and computing and all that sort of thing, and I've never really used the most popular computing platform, so I'm giving it a go.
Yeah, there's no harm. I use it on occasion. I haven't got much to say about it, really. It's just Windows.
The one thing, I genuinely have no idea about this, and it sounds really weird saying this, but should I be using a virus checker?
Well, I think the advice with Windows 10 is that you're probably safer just sticking to Windows Defender. Virus checkers, you know, The whole thing seems to me an extortion racket. So, but yeah, I think Microsoft's own Windows Defender is enough.
Okay, cool.
So they were all finds, I think.
Awesome! It's time for our 80% of the way through reminder. Still to come, we don't have any neurons to vocalize, and we have a small but perfectly formed voice of the masses. If you like the sound of this but would like to subscribe in a paper-based and more coherent form with actual editing, you can do so at linux-magazine.com. Right, now, it's time for the non-existent section, which is the Vocalize Your Neurons. No, it's not. The other one. Yes, it is Vocalize Your Neurons. I apologise. And as Mike's not here, he's on a rail replacement bus somewhere, which is going via Reading or Swindon or Crewe or somewhere. So, for all his smuggery about moving to Germany, I'm going to leave England, I'm going to go and live in Germany, it's better. Like, no, Mike, in your face.
We win.
We win. We've chucked you out of the pound zone. You're going to have to make do with your little friends in France, Spain, Portugal, Romania, Bulgaria, Austria, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Cyprus,
all those useless countries.
Wow, that was impressive. Denmark.
Except you've got Norway, which isn't part of the...
Yeah, I know, I realised that. I was hoping no one would notice. But we've got Wales and Scotland, so we're like super cool. And still to come. Anyway, now it's time for the Voice of the Masses. What do you think of Mozilla's Information Trust Initiative? The Mozilla Foundation, quoth Mike Saunders, for it is he who wrote this. The Mozilla Foundation has its fingers in many pies. Its latest project is the Mozilla Information Trust Initiative, a comprehensive effort to keep the internet credible and healthy. Ooh, good luck. From the site, Mozilla is developing products, research and communities to battle information pollution. Again, good luck. And so-called fake news online. We can't go any further. It's doomed. We're seeking partners and allies to help us do so. They're seeking partners and allies to help them battle information pollution and fake news. Oh, really? Oh, come on, then. Right, then. So, the masses say... Brocker says... The supposed end product is technology that combats misinformation. If they've got something in mind already, they're not letting on. Maybe something akin to phishing protection with a warning screen or pop-up. The best case scenario is that they get other browsing manufacturers to go along with it, which is unlikely given the risk of appearing political or censorious. How many people have the wherewithal to choose Firefox but not smell BS when it's shoved in their face? Tom Walker says it's good that they're giving it a go, but I'm not too optimistic that they'll end up creating something that catches on. As for whether they should just focus on Firefox, it seems like their user base wants them to keep it fast and light rather than adding lots of new features, and I'm guessing they have more funding than they need to achieve that. That point gets a gold star from me. Darren Drapkin says, what on earth do people mean by fast in a system heavily moderated by user input and available network bandwidth? So that's only two real comments there. Oh, really? Why are they doing this? They're trying to filter fake news. This is for cheap headlines, isn't it? This is like 6 months ago when someone from Facebook said, we're going to help our users identify fake news, when actually Facebook is the largest conduit in the sewer of awfulness that is the internet.
But surely that's the first place you should put a filter for fake news, the place where most of it is.
But you say that as if it's as if Facebook is merely a channel. It's a pump for fake news. It's a pump for feces.
Exactly. All the more reason for that. You cut it off at the source.
They're not going to cut anything off. They're taking samples and saying, oh, look what we found, it's horrible. But then increasing the wattage on the turbines that keep driving the fecal matter through. Look at this. This is horrible.
I think... This has been discussed quite a lot before, and my personal opinion once again is that echo chamber is often used to describe what happens. But I think one of the things that's happened with the internet is that it does kind of resonate certain kind of negative voices and stories, and the people that kind of are receptive to them. I think that's what it does. I think that's why Facebook has become so successful, why it's become a fake news thing. And I think that's the real cause of this, just censoring or trying to promote the real story behind a fake news story just isn't going to do anything, because the real problem is the nature of social networking and the way that people respond and consume this kind of information, which isn't going to change. You only have to look at the Daily Mail, which is verging more and more and more into kind of gruesome, grotesque parody of itself in terms of a lot of its stuff now is like live leaks stuff, you know, gore basically, that they're kind of using as clickbait. The Daily Mail Online I'm talking about. And you know, and I think that's how social networks basically work. It's kind of gore clickbait of news. And I don't see how that's going to change by simply trying to inform people that this isn't correct.
I mean, I think you're probably right. And it is the sort of thing that it's whenever you like in, I mean, Twitter's a classic example of this, but all social networks do it to a certain extent. It's distilling everything down to a single sound bite. And whenever you do that, sensationalism always comes to the fore because that's what comes across best in 140 characters or a single image that you share or whatever it is. And nuance just goes out the window. And you're right that while that medium, that sort of way of sharing tiny little things is the main message of getting main way of getting stuff around the internet, there's always going to tend towards sensationalism.
Yeah, but people don't want to care. They just want to be outraged and move on. They just want to vote for Brexit and then they don't want to read the bad news.
Yeah, maybe that is right. But maybe if there was a big flash banner next to the big bus driving around saying, you know, actually that 350 quid's going, a million quid's going nowhere near the NHS, maybe that would have been a good thing.
Well, I think, you know, maybe politicians should be, you know, held accountable for things that have been said that were incorrect. I think it's terrible they haven't been.
Look, it sounds like you're trying to subvert the will of the people, lads. There was a vote. Why can't we not just respect...
The people got what they want. I'm kind of enjoying the freak show now.
Look, you're just both metropolitan elites. You're out of touch with the country.
Yeah.
Stop being, you know, just stop it. Parry it. Stop talking Britain down. I think what we really need... I mean, fair play to Facebook for trying. You know, arguably there's a noble intention behind this, the, you know, reporting fake news, etc. But once you go down that path, you have to have an arbiter who decides what's fake and what's not fake, and that goes against the idea of a free internet. Much as I dislike a lot of the nonsense that is out there. It has to exist. It's just a corollary of the good things that the web provides.
I mean, I'll give an example of something that did something a little bit like this in a slightly different area. And I don't know if it still exists, but there used to be an extension to Firefox or an add-on or whatever they used to call it, called Churnalism. And what that did is when you were looking on websites, news releases and that, it would highlight stuff that had just been copied verbatim from press releases.
Oh, brilliant.
So this is when websites pretending to do reporting, but they couldn't actually be bothered to do any reporting, so they just cut and pasted from the press release. And it just highlighted it. It didn't, you know, delete it, didn't hide it. It just said, this is from the press release. And it worked well in some ways and less well in others, and I haven't used it in a while, and I don't know how well it works now. But that, it was a really simple thing, and it just let you know when someone wasn't doing journalism properly. And I don't know exactly how the same sort of thing could translate to something like this, but, you know, you can always see it like the little Wikipedia citation needed flagged up next to outrageous claims, or just a way of letting you know that something isn't necessarily as true as it could be or isn't supported by fact.
I've got a good example of this sort of good thing. Somebody, some utter hero has written a Chrome extension which replaces the string Liam Fox with the string the disgraced former defence secretary Liam Fox.
Now, I would support Mozilla doing that with a big list that we can maintain ourselves.
Exactly, but Mozilla won't do that. Mozilla doesn't have the ability to do that, and you just can't monitor for fake news because it's so subjective, but you can monitor for the disgraced former defence secretary Liam Fox because he's just one awful, dreadful, scummy man.
I mean, that's one particular example, but what you could do, yeah, is have a way of seeing, for example, what politicians accept money from which lobbyists, and that could be tied in quite easily to your browser. You could have ways of seeing when a news story is reported by a source that has a strong history, or is quoting from a source that has a strong history of proving to be incorrect.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
That is a good idea. Yeah. The second one's a good idea.
I mean, I don't know exactly what form it can work. I don't know exactly what would work in the future, but I think there are things that can be done.
Yeah.
And, you know, we might think, we just throw our hands up in the air and say the future's doomed.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's worth trying.
It should be more like an ad blocker for kind of the integrity of news or fake news. I quite like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't necessarily see it as an advert. I don't want somebody to tell me what
no,
I can't
not,
see.
No, but that's how it operates. I kind of, you know, like ad blocker is a maintaining like a blacklist or a whitelist of sites that are known to peddle misinformation.
It's when you see that flag that comes up that says sponsored content.
Yeah, yeah.
You know it's not as trustworthy as stuff that's got to the top of the search results organically. If you can see something else that says...
Yeah.
Nonsense content.
What we want is
this is probably gibberish.
Accuracy badger.
I refute my early cynicism.
I like the idea of an accuracy badger.
Yeah, totally. Good work, Firefox.
If just like you're on Facebook and that picture with some horrible claim comes on and just a badger comes on and eats the image off your screen.
A badger with a sad face. I don't like this story. I do like this is a good story.
Or turns politicians into spitting image versions of themselves.
To deny them the oxygen of publicity.
Yeah, all terrorists will have no kind of platform. Right, let's wrap this up.
It's late. It's time to go to bed. So, thanks for listening to us, everybody. We do appreciate. I find it. I don't believe you're there, but I do appreciate it that you are. So we will see you in 2 weeks. With hopefully the full continents compliments of Gregory Everard Morrison and also Saunders. Stay tuned, and we're so glad that you're there.
And hopefully without Zappa next time as well. No squeaky chair in the background being attacked.
I quite like Zappa being there.
Yeah, me too.
He's curled up quite peacefully now.
In the feeding chair.
Yeah. A horribly squeaky at the moment, the feeding chair.
Cool. So that brings us to a very dynamic and thrusting end. Night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.